When Time editor Richard Stengel collaborated with Nelson Mandela on his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, he spent nearly 3 years traveling with the South African president, tying his shoes, straightening his tie, collecting hours and hours of conversation. Mandela let him inside his life, his thoughts, and a little bit of his heart. Now, Stengel writes about what he learned from Mandela in those days in a new book, Mandela's Way, 15 Lessons on Life, Love, and Courage. If you have questions about how the great man learned to become the great man, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Richard Stengel now joins us from CNN's radio studios in New York City. Nice to have you with us today.
Great to be with you, Neil.
And many of us would describe Nelson Mandela as a secular saint, but you begin this book by saying he himself would not agree with that. And you also agree that it's not false modesty.
Yes, he doesn't want to be depicted as a saint. He always talked about how flawed he was as a human being. He didn't want to be up on a pedestal where people thought that he was perfect. And one of the things that I wanted to do in the book is there's been a kind of Santa Clausification of Nelson Mandela, this kindly white-haired old man who brought freedom to his people. But he was he's a very, very tough guy. He started the military wing of the ANC when he was a young man. He was a hot-headed, tempestuous revolutionary. He was he was considered a terrorist by the West before he went into prison. So I just wanted to kind of present a full picture of him. And in fact, his greatness comes from the fact that he does have flaws, not that he's flawless.
Indeed, you quote his one-time law partner, Oliver Tambo, who would have become head of the ANC after Mandela went to prison. As a man, Nelson Mandela is passionate, emotional, sensitive, quickly stung to bitterness and retaliation by insult and patronage.
I know, it's kind of amazing, isn't it, Neil? I mean, that isn't the Nelson Mandela we know. That isn't the Nelson Mandela that walked out of prison in 1990. And that, in many ways, the theme of my whole book and the theme of, sort of my quest with working with him on his autobiography is what happened? What changed that young, hot-headed man that Oliver Tambo wrote about into this measured, calm, always, civil, forgiving person who emerged in 1990 and helped reconcile white and black in South Africa. That's in some ways the great mystery.
And the greatest of his teachers, you suggest, was prison.
Yes, because prison changed that young man, and it burned away a lot of the extraneous parts of his character. And again, part of it was through his own self-analysis, but part of it is through this imposed control that prison has on you. I mean, the only thing you could control when you were in prison for all those years was yourself. I mean, I remember when I first went to his cell in Robben Island, and I barely walked in, but I gasped when I saw it because, I mean, Nelson Mandela, as you know, is a big man. He's 6'2" tall. He has big hands and a big head, and he is larger than life in a literal and figurative way. And this prison cell, I mean, he couldn't even lie down and stretch out his legs. I mean, it could barely contain him. But what he learned and what he taught himself was how to contain himself, how to practice the self-control that he actually didn't have before he went into prison.
And there is an episode in the book that happens, well, not so much. It's odd. A problem with his prostrate led to perhaps the great breakthrough where you describe this in the chapter where you say the lesson is to lead from the front. He was in a cell with four other leaders of the ANC, but then after he went to the hospital, comes back to find him in a cell by himself and realizes this is both a message and an opportunity.
Yes. I mean, basically, when he went back, that was then Polesmore Prison, which is where he was after Robben Island. And after his surgery, they moved him back into a cell by himself. And one of the secrets of what kept his body and soul together is that they kept him with his prison mates, who he was sentenced to life in prison with, and they consoled each other. And suddenly he was in a cell by himself, and he had a kind of revelation, which was that the military struggle that the ANC had been practicing all these years would never really overthrow the white apartheid government of South Africa. And given that, why didn't they start negotiations? And this was against all of the ANC policy, which was then headed, as you mentioned, by Oliver Tambo. But he, on his own, decided, you know what, I'm going to start negotiations with the government. And it was an incredibly bold thing to do. And by the way, it also got him in trouble with his colleagues, some of whom felt that he was betraying the movement.
And indeed, there were a lot of people that way. Nevertheless, he did go ahead, start those negotiations, and of course, at some time, he had to then tell his colleagues what he was doing.
Yes, and he chuckled as he told me the story of telling his colleagues, because there were four of them, and two of them said, you know, why didn't you start earlier? And two of them said, you know,
how could
Madiba,
you?
Yeah, it's very, very bad idea. What are you doing?
Because this was the fundamental key question the ANC had argued all along. No, we can never have negotiations until we are treated as equals, indeed, until all those political prisoners are let go.
Exactly. In fact, you know, there was a moment when the white government offered him his release. This is long before 1990, in the 80s, if he renounced the military struggle. And he famously did not. And one of his daughters read his remarks at a speech in Soweto and said, you know, and it had that famous line that only free men can negotiate. And that's the basis on which he rejected being released from prison early.
We're talking with Richard Stengel, editor of Time magazine, about his book, Mandela's Way, 15 Lessons on Life, Love, and Courage. Basically, notes that he kept, or taken from notes that he kept while he spent time with Nelson Mandela as they collaborated on his autobiography. If you'd like to ask about how the great man became the great man, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Let's go to Jesse. Jesse with us from Hartford in Connecticut.
Hello, Neil. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. I am curious to know if maybe you guys could comment, with South Africa coming into the international spotlight with the upcoming FIFA Games in 2010?
The World Cup, yes.
Correct. What is the legacy that is left behind, and sort of what will be the discussion as the world is sort of refocused on South Africa once again? What is the legacy that people will be discussing?
Richard Stengel? Yes,
Jesse, it's a good and fair question, and I mean there wouldn't be a World Cup in South Africa this year if the legacy of Nelson Mandela wasn't the fact that he united the country. He prevented what he thought was possibly imminent, which was a civil war between white conservatives and black freedom fighters. And he felt the country was really on the knife edge of a civil war when he got out, and it was basically his great achievement that he united the country, that he basically said, you know, to the South African whites, hey, let's keep the past behind us. He said to the great rank and file of his own voters, you know, let's be patient and let's move together. This is a great rainbow nation of all different colors, and we have to move together with one person, one vote democracy. I mean, that's his great legacy. And, the nation has been pretty successful economically since then. I mean, it does have some very difficult structural problems, a very high HIV rate, a high crime rate. But it really did exceed expectations, particularly those who thought the country would descend into a civil war. It had never been a situation like what happened in South Africa before.
Jesse, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Last year, we saw this film about rugby, Invictus. You know Nelson Mandela well. How much of that was true?
Well, it's it was based on a lovely book called "Playing the Enemy" by John Carlin, and I wrote a little bit about it in Mandela's Way. The truth of it was, one of the chapters in my book is Know Your Enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that Mandela did when he was in prison is he taught himself Afrikaans, he studied Afrikaner history. He memorized Afrikaans poetry, and part of learning about, the Afrikaner, the white South African basically who had imposed apartheid on that country, was that their favorite sport was rugby. And, Mandela always said, to appeal to people, you have to appeal to their head and their heart. And him understanding rugby, embracing rugby, was a way of appealing to the Afrikaner's heart, and he hoped the heart of the nation. And so it became a kind of symbol and even metaphor for what Mandela was trying to achieve as a whole. So, I mean, the basic truth of it, I think, is absolutely correct and fair.
There is another chapter you write in your book. We think of Nelson Mandela as, if anything else, utterly fearless and according to what you write, nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, he, you know, one of the things, Neil, that I found so fascinating and amazing when I was talking to him, and we did many, many, many hours of interviews for Long Walk to Freedom, was he would often say, you know, I was terrified, or I was very scared that the guard was going to assault me, or he was constantly saying, or often said, you know, that he was feeling fear. And I, at first, I just thought it was amazing. I mean, here is one of the greatest heroes of the 20th century, one of the greatest heroes ever, expressing this fear. And I would ask him about it, and he would say, "Well, Richard, it would be irrational not to be afraid, wouldn't it?" And what I realized was that part of his courage is that he would admit to being scared, but part of his courage was him analyzing his own situation and saying, "Look, I'm a symbol, I'm a leader. I feel fear here, but I have to camouflage it. I have to, as he often said, put up a front." So all of these, many of these occasions when other prisoners or other people or other South Africans looked up to Mandela as this fearless hero, he was, you know, feeling the same kind of anxieties and fears and trepidations that we all feel, but he managed to rise above it. I mean, that is what makes him a great hero, I think.
One of the great stories Richard Stengel tells in Mandela's Way is about an airplane flight that Nelson Mandela took with one of his bodyguards, a man named Mike, who halfway through the flight, a twin-prop plane, and one of the propellers stopped turning. Nelson Mandela looked up from his newspaper, noticed that, and told Mike to inform the pilot and went back to his newspaper. Mike said he was utterly terrified of this, but looked at Mandela, who was just calmly reading his newspaper, landed, and then later Richard Stengel took a car ride with Nelson Mandela, who told him, "I was absolutely terrified up there."
Now, and again, talking to Mike afterwards, I mean, Mike said the only thing that calmed him, and this was probably his, second or third airplane trip in his whole life, was that even while the plane was landing, Mandela was just very calmly reading the newspaper like he was, you know, commuting in from his suburban home to the office. And again, as Mandela said, that was him putting up a front, pretending not to be scared. And that calmed Mike, and it probably calmed the pilots and calmed all the people on the ground.
The name of the book is Mandela's Way, 15 Lessons on Life, Love, and Courage. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go next to Dan. Dan's on the line from Wilmington, Delaware.
Hi. I was wondering what impact or effect did Dr. King and the American civil rights movements of the 60s have on Nelson Mandela and his freedom struggle in South Africa?
You know, Dan, it's a good question, and there's probably a slightly disappointing answer to Americans, and I count myself in that group. I mean, Mandela, you know, South Africa was of course a British colony. Mandela never much looked to America. He knew about the Constitution, the founding, and Abraham Lincoln. But by the time the civil rights movement in America was in high gear, he was already in prison. I mean, he was in prison in 1964. There probably wasn't much news that they got in South Africa in those days from America. Remember that part of a totalitarian government that South Africa had was that it kept out news like that. So he wasn't all that influenced by it. I mean,
one of the great questions, the American Civil Rights Movement was, of course, built on the example of Gandhi and nonviolence. And clearly that was not the path chosen by Nelson Mandela and the ANC.
But Neil, as you know, Gandhi spent his formative years in South Africa, and Gandhi was indeed a great influence on the ANC and Nelson Mandela. It really wasn't until, you know, the very early 60s that the ANC renounced nonviolence. I mean, nonviolence was, they embraced it partly from that Gandhian tradition. But as Mandela told me at the time, and I write about in the book, you know, he had one overarching goal, which was to bring freedom to his people and his nation. And everything else was a tactic or a strategy, as he would say. And he said to me very, very frankly, you know, nonviolence, as far as I was concerned, was a tactic. It wasn't a moral imperative or principle. And that's a pretty hard truth about Nelson Mandela.
Interesting. We were talking with some of the veterans of SNCC last week, celebrating their 50th anniversary down at Shaw College in North Carolina. Indeed, they were talking very much along the same lines. Nonviolence was a tactic. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. Thank you very much, Dan. Let's go to Craig. Craig with us from Cedar Rapids in Iowa.
Well, you almost answered my question. I just wondered how much Nelson Mandela was familiar with and followed Gandhi, and did Martin Luther King, was he a student of Gandhi too?
Well, he was a student of Gandhi, but yes. Craig, a little bit more about Gandhi's relationship to the ANC.
Yes, I mean, the ANC certainly followed Gandhi's model in South Africa. Remember, Gandhi was then, I mean, he was an Indian lawyer in South Africa, and the protests he was leading weren't for everybody. It was for Indian South Africans and to get them to have more privileges and more equality before the law. The ANC was then a completely African and black organization, and they watched what Gandhi did and they learned from it. In fact, you know, it was only later that the ANC even opened its doors to non-Africans and to Indians, and the Indian members of the ANC were a great influence on Mandela. One of his great, great comrades all those years in prison was Ahmed Kathrada. Kathrada was a great student of Gandhi, and that helped educate Mandela into the Gandhian way, Satyagraha, which they eventually, of course, they renounced.
We just have a few seconds left with you, and I wanted to ask you, so much of your book is about your personal experience with Nelson Mandela, everything from the shine of his smile to the profound disappointment of his frown.
Yes, I mean, and Neil, as you know, I mean, he was a huge influence in my life. I mean, he urged me to marry my wife. He's godfather to my two sons. You know, he changed my life profoundly. And again, you know, having to spend a certain number of years of my life thinking what would Nelson Mandela do is something that's a pretty good exercise for everybody. So it's partially the book is partially my gratitude and teach those lessons that he learned at a fraction of the cost that he had to pay.
Mandela's Way, 15 Lessons on Life, Love, and Courage. Richard Stengel, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Neil.
You can read more about how Mandela's years in prison molded him and taught him important lessons about how to be a leader in an excerpt at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Tomorrow, Political Junkie Day. Ken Rudin's with us. Join us for that. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.